Thank you. Well, thanks so much for your kind introduction, and thanks for inviting me to speak with you today. It really is my pleasure to be here. My name is Wesley Wong, and I'm a principal investigator of the Single Molecule Force Studies Group at the Rowland Institute at Harvard University, which is this special place, and we'll spend a lot of time at the Rowland. It is a really neat place. While I'm kind of currently from the Boston area, I'm more originally from around here. I was born and grew up in Peterborough, and so to be able to come and share some cool stuff with you guys, it really is a pleasure. So one of the overarching goals of my group is to try to understand how biological systems work at the nanoscale. And to do this, we basically develop and apply new techniques in single molecule manipulation in order to do this. So today, basically, I'm going to give you a couple snapshots. One of them is a develop, and that's this new tool that I call single molecule centrifugation. And the other thing is an application, which is basically using this kind of approach in order to study enzyme kinetics. So here's just the overview. I'm just going to start by telling you a little bit about the kinds of things that we can learn from single molecule experiments. I'm not going to belabor it. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. And then I'm going to talk about this project on von Willebrand factor, which is a very important adhesion molecule, which plays an important role in blood clotting. And I'm going to show how physiological forces in the body actually act on a single molecule mechanical switch to basically help you regulate your hemostatic potential, your ability to form blood clots. And then lastly, I'm going to talk about one of these high-risk, crazy idea instruments that I developed my group at the Rowland Institute, and it's basically a new way to do single molecule measurements, not one molecule at a time, but many, many at a time, while still retaining all of the control and resolution that we want from the best single molecule experiments. All right, so there are lots of different ways that we can explore biomolecular interactions, but I hope through the course of this talk it'll become clear to you that single molecule techniques give us a unique way to basically make new insights into physics, chemistry, biology, and medicine. Some of the advantages are obvious, that unlike an ensemble measurement that you do in, say, a test tube, single molecule techniques give you a way to basically observe molecular transitions, such as the binding together of, say, two proteins, or the folding or unfolding of a protein, to observe these transitions directly, and even allowing you to see the metastable states along the way, instead of just having them all averaged out. Equally importantly, for understanding the environment of the cell, it allows us to study systems out of equilibrium and under force. And so, you know, as you sit on this chair and feel force on your rear and you move around, we're not equilibrium systems. We don't live in a test tube. We're composed of cells and all these beautiful molecular nanomachines. And so we really have to explore them at that level if we were to understand how they work in our bodies. And the overarching goal, of course, is to develop real quantitative and physical understanding of life at the nanoscale. So a few kind of classic examples of single molecule experiments you may be aware of. A lot of the pioneering work in this field was done here using optical tweezers and looking at the mechanics of DNA. So you can see here some work done by Carlos Bustamante, where there's one tiny bead held in pipette, one held in an optical trap, which I'll talk more about in a little bit. And in between it is a single molecule of double-stranded DNA. And here they really investigated the mechanics of this molecule, and people have studied how the mechanics depend on things as how much you twist it up and wind it up. Another interesting experiment, a set of experiments was done on molecular motors. And these are very interesting because they're really able to convert chemical energy to real mechanical motion, mechanical energy. And you can see here again a bead held in an optical trap linked to this motor kinesin, and it's walking along a microtubule. So a lot of this work was done by Steve Block, who pioneered a lot of this also at the Rowland Institute. And lastly, as we're going to talk about in the upcoming section, forces arise very naturally in your body, for example, in the bloodstream, and we'll show that molecules there not only have to contend with force, but in fact have been designed to use force in meaningful ways. And we're going to show basically how these forces are able to regulate enzyme activity. So I guess I'm going to start by asking a very physical question, and that's, what is the strength of biomolecular interaction? Like, what are we to think about when we think of strength? And shown here is just a cartoon of an energy landscape, and you can see basically here is, say, a receptor and ligand, two molecules stuck to each other, and it lives here in this bound state, and it's separated from being apart by this energy barrier. And basically when I said before, what we're interested in is weak non-covalent interactions. And what I mean by that is that basically this energy barrier is on the order of the thermal energy, or kT, or tens of kT. And so in the thermalized aqueous environment of the cell, random kicks from the environment are enough to cause this bond to fall apart under no external force at all. So then the question becomes, what is strength then if these molecules fall apart even when you don't pull on them at all? And basically, strength is now tied implicitly to lifetime. So if you have a molecule, a pair of molecules, if you're willing to wait long enough, this thing will fall apart. But if you want it to fall apart on a faster time scale, you have to give it a little bit of a pull. And so basically, on this picture, the way we model that is that when you apply a constant force, it adds a linear potential, which mainly brings this barrier down. And in the simplest case, this basically exponentiates the rate at which these things fall apart. And in the body, as I said, these forces can arise due to, for example, fluid flow. In the laboratory, what we do is we basically link one molecule to one side, another molecule to another side, and use ultra-sensitive springs in order to measure and apply forces between molecules. So, as I said, this is just simply the simplest picture you may think of an energy landscape. It's 1D, it's a single sharp barrier. Even a slightly more complex picture would involve having some inner barriers inside, and this really underscores the types of things that we can learn under force. For example, in an equilibrium measurement, the kinetics would be dominated by this outer barrier here. You'd basically never see this inner hidden barrier. But if we apply a little bit of force, it tilts the energy landscape, we can actually make this inner barrier the dominant one, and it'll govern the kinetics. So force in the lab allows us to do two things. One is to mimic situations in which these molecules are under force, understand them in a more natural environment. And secondly, it gives us a way to probe the energy landscape of these kind of interesting interactions. And so this concept has largely been encapsulated in the technique known as dynamic force spectroscopy, which was largely pioneered by Evan Evans. So during my PhD, which I did in physics at Harvard, I basically had two advisors. One was David Nelson, and then one was Evan Evans. And basically, the approach of dynamic force spectroscopy is by pulling on a bond at many different rates, many different times, gives you a way to start to image the prominent barriers to bond association. So for example, if you have a single sharp barrier in 1D, and you were to pull it at a constant loading rate, so the loading rate is just the rate at which force is applied, what you find is that the most likely rupture force increases roughly linearly with the logarithm of the loading rate. However, if you pull this molecule apart fast enough that this inner barrier becomes dominant before this molecule has a chance to fall apart, you now have kinetics governed by a different barrier, giving you a different piecewise linear curve. So basically, by pulling this molecule at different rates over a large span and loading rate, as you said, by piecing together a spectrum like this, you can start to learn about the kinetic barriers to dissociation. One thing I'd like to point out is this picture here actually hides, I guess, represents a lot of data. So bond rupture is a stochastic process. So every time you pull on it, you get a different force. Because as I said, if you just wait long enough, this thing will fall apart, and basically it falls apart with some kind of distribution. And so each one of these dots really represents hundreds to thousands of experiments in which someone takes a single pair of molecules and pulls it apart and looks to see the rupture force, and you basically plot the distribution, and plotted here is basically the peak of that distribution. So while a graph like this can be very enlightening as far as how these molecules interact, it can be very time-consuming and really take months or even years to generate enough data to really characterize a pair of molecules, because you really have to do many experiments at many different rates. So in order to do this kind of experiment, you can see that we need to have specialized instruments that can study things at the nanometer length scale, piconewton force scale, and the thermal energy scale, which in these units is about 4 piconewton nanometers. So to do this, we have ultra-sensitive force probes. These are a few that you're probably familiar with. They are largely complementary and have their own pluses and minuses. Here's an atomic force microscope, or AFM. It's basically a mechanical cantilever. So basically, you can kind of bring something down, and as you pull up, this lever bends, and by measuring the deflection, you can measure the force. And it's good for studying pretty stiff things, forces on the order of 10 to 10 to thousands of piconewtons. In the middle is a magnetic tweezer system in which magnetic forces are used to apply forces to single molecules. And on the left is an optical tweezer system, and This is one of the instruments that I'm going to talk to you about today. For the uninitiated, ocular tweezers are kind of a magical thing the first time you see them. It's almost like a tractor beam in Star Trek, where basically if you take laser light and you focus it with a high numerical aperture objective, it creates a stable 3D potential or optical trap near the focus, which is able to bring in small dielectric particles and stably hold them there at the middle. And basically, as you displace something from the center, it experiences a restoring force that brings it back to the center of the trap. So it's a very versatile spring that you can control. And in the second part of the talk, I'm going to show you a new instrument that I invented, which complements these other instruments, but also has its own advantages. And that's an instrument that we call the centrifuge force microscope. And this instrument is neat in that it's able to basically apply forces over the entire range of all the other instruments combined, and also to do things instead of on one molecule at a time, on really tens of thousands of molecules at a time, taking experiments that used to take weeks and letting you do them in minutes. So, but first, let me talk to you about something kind of, a specific example of something that we can learn from this kind of approach to really convince you that it's worth going through all this effort. So as I promised before, I said that I'd talk about an important adhesion molecule and blood clotting protein known as von Willebrand factor. Now, the human body really has to strike a very delicate balance for its hemostatic or blood clotting potential. If you clot too readily, you can form thrombuses in your bloodstream, which can lead to all sorts of things such as stroke or infarction and really block up your blood vessels, which can be very dangerous. But if you don't clot readily enough, if you get cut or injured, your body isn't actually able to bring bleeding to an end. And a really important player in this is a molecule known as von Willebrand factor. And von Willebrand factor is a large molecule. It's actually the largest known soluble blood protein. And it has a bunch of different functions. And one thing that it does is it's able to, for example, stick platelets to each other to form hemostatic platelet plugs and stick platelets to sites of trauma. And so you can see here a few of the things that von Willebrand factor can do. It's this long molecule. It's a polymer. It consists of many repeated monomers. And each monomer actually has a rich domain structure. So I guess a couple of domains I want to point out are the A1 domain, which can bind to a protein called GP1B, which is expressed on platelets, and the A3 domain, which can bind to collagen, which is exposed at sites of trauma. So you have some endothelial cells scraped away and have some collagen. And so you can see here that basically you can form a tether, as I described, really allowing you to form a platelet plug for a primary hemostasis and enabling you to stop bleeding out. But the regulation of this is very important and very subtle, and a lot of the regulation takes part in this domain in between, known as the A2 domain. So for example, if you have a blood clot growing, you can imagine you want a way to trim it so it doesn't actually fill your whole blood vessel. Equally importantly, the ability to form these blood clots and these platelet plugs depends on the length of this molecule. The longer it is, the more sticky parts it has, and the more readily it recruits some platelets to each other. And so you basically want to be able to control the size of this molecule. And the A2 domain, together with a special enzyme known as ATOM-TS13, which can cleave it, is the main regulatory feature of this molecule for adjusting these two things. So early experiments showed that the activity of this enzyme on A2, its ability to cleave, seems to depend on the shear rate of the environment that these molecules were in. And so what we tested was a hypothesis that, in fact, fluid forces and environmental forces on the molecule in the blood flow are enough to cause a conformational change in this molecule, namely unfolding, and that in turn, this conformational change can enable enzymatic cleavage. So in other words, we tested the hypothesis that force can act as a cofactor here in the system. And the way we did it was by directly applying forces using optical tweezers. So this collaboration was done with Tim Springer, who is a professor at Harvard Medical School, and he made this beautiful construct, which consists of a single A2 domain covalently linked to DNA handles. And in my lab, we basically linked up this molecule to two different beads. You can see one bead is about a couple microns in diameter. It's held in a small glass micropipette, which is controlled by a piezo. And the other bead, again, about 1 or 2 microns in diameter, is held in an optical trap. And in between them, we have this molecular tether. The spring to the left is not a real spring. It's just basically a conceptual spring to show you that as we pull this bead to the right, it experiences a restoring force back into the center of the trap. And for small displacements, it's basically like a Hookean spring. So this project, the first thing that we wanted to do is really characterize the kinetics of unfolding and refolding of this molecule, and the next part, and how it depended on force. And the next part was basically studying how force can affect this enzyme activity. So you can see here the basic way that an experiment goes. The basic protocol is to repeatedly stretch and relax this molecule. And you can see here three cycles of that. Here's force versus time. And you can see here a ramping of the force. And as we increase the force, when an unfolding event occurred, we'd see a sudden blip because this molecule would open up and decrease the force momentarily. And then basically we would decrease the force and then we'd hold it, hold the molecule at different forces and then pull back out again. And if refolding occurred in that interval, we'd be able to see this little blip a second time. And if no refolding occurred, we wouldn't be able to see the blip. There are other molecules we've worked with in which we could actually see the molecule contracting and refolding, but A2 wasn't one of them. We basically had to basically hold and wait and study refolding kinetics and statistics. So this transition is perhaps more easily seen in what they call a force extension curve. This is basically how the force changes as a function of the extension. For a simple hooking spring, this is just basically look at like a straight line that the force ramps up linearly as you stretch it out. For a polymer, you can see basically you start with very, very little force as basically it's very soft, and it very quickly starts asymptoting as you start pulling out all the wrinkles. And you can see here this red curve. As we start pulling on this molecule, you go up this red curve, and an unfolding event is observed as a sudden sharp increase in the length of the molecule. You can see here this sharp transition, and then we pull back out. And then when we decrease the force, we ride back along this black curve. So then we wait. And then we pull back out again. If you come back along black, it means no refolding occurred. But if you come back along red and then pop out, it means that refolding had occurred. So in this way, we were able to characterize the kinetic rates of unfolding and refolding. So what did we see? So as I showed you before, there was a very simple cartoon of an energy landscape, a single sharp barrier and bound state in one dimension. And what this model predicts is that the unfolding rate should basically depend exponentially on the force. And even though this is a simple model, experimentally we found it actually was in very good agreement with the data. So you can see over three orders of magnitude in loading rate, we basically get a straight line here. Furthermore, as I said, each time you pull, you have to build up statistics to get a distribution. And the simple model also describes what the distribution should look like, which you can see actually fits the model reasonably well. But regardless of what model you want to use, the bottom line is this little A2 domain, this little molecule, is an extremely sensitive force switch. So in the absence of force, this thing will stay together and hold together for over 1,000 seconds. But even a tiny amount of force, one piconewton of force, is enough to accelerate this unfolding E-fold, or almost threefold. And a piconewton is a very small amount of force. It's kind of the level of force that a single molecular motor can apply. And I guess another way to, yeah, so it's a small amount of force. The other thing which was interesting about this experiment was it also gives us a way to see short-lived metastable states that would otherwise be difficult to catch. And so what we observed was as we unfolded this molecule, it would often pause briefly at a partially unfolded state before going all the way. And so we could also start looking at these transitions and characterizing kinetics of that, but I'm not going to go into it in this talk because there's lots of interesting ground to cover. So as I said, the flip side is to look at the refolding kinetics, and the way we did that was by basically using maximum likelihood estimation, since we couldn't directly observe these events. So we'd hold it at different amounts of time and pull out again and see, as a function of the amount of time you wait and the force that you hold it at, what fraction of them basically refold. Shown here basically is that even a tiny amount of force is able to prevent this thing from refolding. So even just a couple piconewtons of force will cause a fraction refolded in even 10 seconds to be only about half. Whereas in the absence of force, this thing folds together pretty quickly. The one thing I do want to point out is these lines are not a fit to the data. It's just a visual representation so you can basically see the saturation. The maximum likelihood analysis basically just takes all the data, you just throw it in, and basically finds the most likely parameters of the model for the data that we collected. And the one kind of interesting thing I want to point out is that we modified what was mentioned before, that the standard model of dynamic force spectroscopy of a single sharp barrier in 1D worked pretty well for unfolding, it doesn't work that great for refolding. So we had to modify it a little bit. Because what the standard model assumes, not the physics standard model, but the standard equations that people use, is that as you apply a force, the distance between your starting state and the transition state doesn't really change. But it's pretty clearly not true for a soft molecule, right? This molecule is unfolded, it's floppy. You apply a little bit of force and it stretches out and you move away from the transition state and the folded state. So basically we just modified the landscape by putting a harmonic potential here, and so now the force goes with F squared instead of with F. But it's kind of a detail for people who are interested in kind of single molecule mechanics. But the bottom line again is that this thing will fold back up and heal quickly in the absence of force, but even a tiny amount of force is able to keep this thing unfolded. All right, so what does this mean? It's a great sensor. But what use is a sensor if nothing happens downstream? And the downstream thing is enzymatic cleavage. And so what we did next was we flowed in this this enzyme, and what we showed was that in the folded state, this thing would not get cut. But once it unfolded, it enabled the enzyme to come and cut it. So we were able to show definitively, so here's some data basically. You unfold the molecule in the presence of some enzyme and cleavage occurs. You unfold it, no enzyme, no cleavage occurs. And the other graph, which isn't here, is when there is no unfolding, but the enzyme, there's no cleavage. So what we were able to show for the first time was that force really does act as a cofactor for enzymatic cleavage. That is, force is necessary for cleavage to occur because otherwise this molecule just hangs around for a long, long time. And we went further than that and actually were able to characterize all of the kinetics as a function of enzyme concentration and fit it to a single molecule Michaelis-Menten equation. So this is all well and good, but the big question, okay, so A2 is a great force sensor and it's actually able to trigger an event. But is this physiological? Should we actually care about it from a standpoint of our health, a standpoint of medicine, a standpoint of biology? Is a force, for example, strong enough in the bloodstream? And so what we did was we made some simple estimates. So for example, if you just take a polymer and put it in a shear flow and assume the polymer is stretched out, you can calculate the tension in this polymer. And basically what you find is that the maximum tension occurs in the center, and that maximum tension increases quadratically with the length of this polymer. And so for von Willebrand factor polymers of about the size you expect in the body, you expect to get a maximum force of about 10 piconewtons and a maximum loading rate of about 25 piconewtons per second. And we got the loading rates from some beautiful simulations done by Alfredo Alexander Katz at MIT and by Matthias Schneider, who's now at BU. And now we can do kind of the dangerous thing for a physicist in biology, and that's actually to make a quantitative prediction. And from our single molecule measurements, we can basically predict at 25 piconewtons per second, what do we expect the most likely unfolding force to be, and therefore the most likely cleavage force to be. And what we find is it's about 10 piconewtons per second. And so what's interesting is for multimers which are significantly longer than this, we expect them to experience a tension much higher than the most likely unfolding force, and therefore to get unfolded and cut down and made smaller. And for molecules that are significantly smaller, we expect them not to generate enough tension to get cut up even further. And so we're basically able to start making predictions about the size distribution of this in the bloodstream. And this is very important because your ability to form blood clots depends on the size distribution. And so doctors can actually do this experiment in patients. You give someone a drug, I think it's called vasopressin, and it basically causes their endothelial cells to extrude what's called ultra-large von Willebrand factor. So this molecule, but way longer than it should be. And it seems that as long as the patients have properly functioning A2 molecules and ATOM TS13 molecules, within a short amount of time, not short, maybe tens of minutes, basically the body is able to cut this down to get the right size distribution so nothing crazy happens. And the size distribution is, in fact, about what we predict from their single molecule measurements. But on the other hand, if they have some disease, perhaps some mutation, they immediately go into a TTP or some kind of thrombotic, very dangerous condition. And so this is kind of interesting. What we were able to show is that this very important physiological regulation is done by molecular feedback mechanism. And it's really one molecule. It's really physiological forces acting a single molecule mechanical switch that's used by the body to regulate hemostasis. So we're continuing work on this project. For example, von Willebrand's disease is the most common heritable blood disorder, probably up to Some estimates are up to 1% of the population, so possibly even people in this room have von Willebrand's disease, but at the quantitative level, so if someone were to take your blood and run a gel and look at the size distribution and test how readily you can form platelet plugs, it might be a little bit less than most people. And for a smaller fraction of the population, it's a very dangerous condition. And so we're going to start looking at different mutations and whatnot. But I hope, at the very least, this project it can convince you that this is that this type of approach, looking at biological molecules one at a time and under force, can really reveal interesting insights. But perhaps it also reveals to you some of the difficulties with methods like this. And so in the next few slides, I'm going to show you my solution to some of these challenges. And one of the challenges is that it's very time-consuming to do an experiment one molecule at a time, especially when you want to build up statistics. And if, for example, you want to study the genetic basis for some of these physical properties and look at mutations, it may be the barrier to actually getting the answer may be so high that it's not even worth it. So it's very expensive in terms of time. And secondly, it's very expensive in terms of expense. I mean, the instrument that we used to take these measurements costs upwards of $100,000, $200,000. And I feel like there's a lot of potential for this type of instrument to make real inroads in terms of medicine and biology, but we need to kind of come up with a way to do this kind of thing more effectively and more efficiently. So now I'm going to show you the kind of cool thing that I developed in my lab at the Roland Institute. And you know, one of the things in my mind was like, well, I'm at Roland, I have all these resources, but I'd like to be able to figure out a way so that, you know, it doesn't require crazy resources in order to do this kind of measurement. So here's another picture of the optical tweezers. This is a slightly different geometry that we sometimes use. And here we have a bead, you know, a micron-sized bead, and it's been tethered to a surface by a single molecule. So instead of bead, this is bead surface, but it's the same concept. We apply a force on it optically with this optical trap pulling upwards. Again, this spring is just a conception to show that we're pulling upwards. We use video microscopy mixed with interference to image the three-dimensional position of this bead. And it's actually neat. It's a very simple and inexpensive approach where you just reflect light up through your objective, and some reflects from the glass-wire interface, and some reflects from the bead surface itself and forms these Newton ring patterns. And if you analyze these patterns properly, you can basically get the tether distance at the angstrom level. And I did a lot of this work during my PhD with Evan Evans and David Nelson. And the force applied by this trap has been stabilized, so we can apply very slow and very small forces. So it's stable on the order of femtonewtons or tens of femtonewtons. So we can really start to study both unfolding events as well as watch refolding directly. And this was a great instrument. Oops, let's see, here we go. And so, for example, I used it to study the unfolding refolding of a spectrin molecule, which is an important cytoskeletal protein. And you can see here these force extension curves and all these transitions. But it was a very painful experiment. It took me months to even get a handful of data traces. And so when I had my new lab, my own lab, the idea was like, is there a better way to do this so it isn't painful for anybody? And so the basic idea is instead of doing one molecule at a time, doing multiple molecules at a time. And our detection technique is already highly multiplexed. I mean, you can get video cameras these days with literally millions or tens of millions of sensors on them. And with a phase-sensitive detection such as this, even looking at a handful of pixels in the center allow you to determine the position of this this gap distance fairly accurately. Because, you know, it's now you've kind of decoupled your resolution of this distance from your spatial lateral resolution. Because the important thing is basically the brightness of the spot goes from dark when the bead is right against the surface to bright again when it's basically quarter wavelength out from the surface. And so basically your detection comes down to how well you can distinguish light from dark as opposed to spatial resolution. But on the other hand, the optical trap is not that multiplexed. I mean, you can start splitting your beam, but you can only do that so much until you don't have enough power to really apply significant forces. And so the crazy idea I had one lunch hour was just, what if we took our whole microscope, turned it on its side, and just spun the entire thing? To really come up with a way to, instead of applying forces to one molecule at a time, to really potentially hundreds of thousands or millions. And my postdoc, who is a good friend of mine, and we were in grad school together, was like, hey, that's not a bad idea. Maybe we can do this. Maybe it's easy. And so we did, and it was fun, and we called it the centrifuge force microscope. So this is a pretty new thing. And basically, the idea is to rotate the entire microscope to apply centrifugal forces to the entire sample. And here, the force is coupling to mass density. And to apply force to single molecules by using a tethered bead assay, and to leverage all of this kind of video tracking and image analysis technologies and approaches that we've already developed. Now, here's just a schematic picture of the instrument. You can see basically imaging arm, a microscope arm, mounted onto a rotary stage, and the whole thing spins. And basically, the geometry is such that the cover slip is here, the camera is here, the beads are tethered to this surface, and then the entire assembly spins, and so the molecules pull away from the surface, and we can observe them even as simply as just looking at the blur out of the focal plane. So here's how it actually looks. Here's a first-generation instrument, and it turns out it's actually very easy to make a tiny microscope. You just order a couple of parts from Thor Labs, and so here you can see just a video camera is connected by just a Thor Labs tube to a microscope objective, a little sample, and an LED, and then the entire thing is mounted on a rotary stage. Ah, gamma. Can you see this okay? Or is it, it's a little dim, I apologize. Oh, do you mind killing the light?
Sure.
It's kind of... It's not that bad. You can calculate it, and it's actually quite small. You can observe it, and so we were concerned about... So what was interesting about this is often you have an idea, and it turns out to be harder to do than you thought, and all these things prop up. Whereas in this case, we thought of all these things that could go wrong, and none of them basically went wrong. It turned out it was fine. So, for example, vibrations are not a huge issue because the entire thing is one rigid piece. So at least visually, even this thing is vibrating, the image looks fine. Secondly, as long as you're in the overdamp regime and everything is low Reynolds number, the vibrations don't really couple into our forces because you're just moving the boundary. The second thing that you worried about fluid motion, what we did is we put some neutrally buoyant spheres in it to basically look at the fluid flow, and we saw that they were moving very, very slowly. And I have a friend of mine who's just, he can calculate anything in any field. It's a string theory, he does like condensed matter, he does fluid, he does everything, and he came by my lab a month or so ago, he was a roommate of mine. I just asked him, like, can we just calculate this? I was always curious what it was. And you can think of it very simply, in fact, as basically just, I guess the simplest picture is just you just have a vessel and you just rotate it. So if you want to look at the relative motion kind of shearing inside the actual chamber, you can kind of go into the frame in which you're basically at the center of that. And you can just calculate, even for like this rectangular sample chamber, the rate of rotation as a function of acceleration. So certainly when you're at a constant rotation rate, there's no motion at all, it's all steady state. And as you're accelerating, you can also calculate exactly what the fluid velocity is. And it's very, very small. And so basically the forces that you'd add to it would be the drag forces against the bead, but it's really negligible compared to all the other forces involved. So that's cool. The whole thing spins around, and while it spins, we have a live video feed the whole time of what's happening. I will say this was the one thing that was a little harder to do than we thought, getting the live video out the whole time. But we kind of came up with a clever solution. We basically pass it through a fiber optic joint right through the center, and that's a nice high bandwidth way to do it. So it was cheap and easy, and you can just buy it all and just put it together. And so basically what you'll see here is a whole bunch of beads. Each bead represents an individual single molecule experiment, and some of them are tethered by a piece of DNA, and some of them aren't. And as you spin it up, what you'll see is the beads tethered by a piece of DNA will go into the screen and become blurry, whereas the beads that are not will stay stuck to the surface. And then we're going to refocus on the interesting ones, the tethered ones, and the rest of the world that is uninteresting to us fades away from view. So you can see here, all the molecules jiggling. Oh, that didn't play through so well. Let's try again. Okay, this thing spins. And then the molecules and then the beads jiggle. There we go, they're jiggling. So they swoop down and then they swing out and become blurry. And then we refocus on them so we can see what this molecule is doing. But you can see how excited we were because up to this point, we were doing experiments, and most people in the field, on one of these circles at a time. and it takes forever to collect statistics when you're doing one circle at a time. And here you can see in one field of view literally hundreds, and next slide you'll see literally thousands of single molecule experiments at the same time. But first I'll just zoom into this a little so you can actually see what's happening. Jiggly beads, hanging down, swinging out, refocusing. And we refocus with a piezo, which is just mounted at the tip of this. Okay, so it's cool, but can we do something useful with it? And as I said before, a very basic approach that people use for looking at single molecules is dynamic force spectroscopy, in which they really want to collect statistics of rupture forces and rupture times. And so you can see here, we basically studied the force-dependent antibody antigen unbinding kinetics of literally thousands of molecules at a time. And so they start off, all of these beads are sharp. We use DNA as a molecular signature to separate out the good molecules of interest from the bad ones that are just stuck to the surface. So we then focus one tether length into the screen. Everything becomes blurry. We spin it. As it spins it, lots of beads leave the field of view, and the ones of interest to us become sharp. And then we just wait, and we can just watch in time as these beads leave and count one by one to get the kinetics of bond rupture. So, now the issue is we can collect data quickly, but we have to analyze it. And so we have some software that can do things like find where all the circles are and determine, for example, which ones are stuck to the surface and which ones aren't. We can look at just the variance in this box. We can determine what time they rupture at. And you can see you actually don't have to do anything fancy to look at bond rupture, because in fact, if you just look at the square and calculate the variance of the image within the square, it goes to zero when the bead disappears, because now you just have a blank background. You can see things such as molecular transitions as they occur, and for one field of view, you can really get hundreds of statistics. So, for example, we can characterize the force-dependent lifetime of this molecule in, to show you how powerful this is, in the amount of time we've been speaking, we can actually characterize the entire force-dependent lifetime experiment that would otherwise take us weeks with the optical trap. So this is pretty neat and has a lot of benefits. We can do thousands of single molecule experiments at the same time, taking things that used to take days to minutes, months to hours. We can get additional statistics to try to build a more comprehensive view of how molecules work. And we can in fact study entire families of interactions in parallel. For example, as I said, we're gonna start looking at mutations in Wolfram's disease. And instead of each experiment taking months, we can really do many in parallel. And a lot of the benefits come from this force field, which is accurate, dynamically controllable, uniform, and calibration-free. And if you work with a single molecule field, you'll see that these are really, really good benefits, because often it's a real pain in the neck to try to like, calibrate the strength of your interaction. Whereas here, you can literally use high-scale physics, mv squared over r, and it basically works perfectly. And we can do an entire range of forces from femtonewtons to nanonewtons, and do even new studies by coupling to the mass density. And again, it's great because it's so inexpensive and simple to operate. It doesn't require a team of PhD physicists and hundreds of thousands of dollars. It kind of opens up the field and increases the accessibility of single molecule measurements. I guess in summary, I do a bunch of different things, both developing new technology and approaches from optical tweezers, high-resolution tracking. This is kind of a fun project. I was telling Will about last time I was here, and he thought it was neat. It's kind of a way to get high-frequency information out by deconvolving image blur. And again, it's one of these neat things I like to do that, like, if you want to get high dynamic information out from, say, a video camera, typically you may have to spend, $100,000 to get a million frame per second camera. But in fact, you don't have to if you understand the blur pattern. And we basically showed that it was just a simple, inexpensive LED, which you can probably get for a few dollars. And by oscillating it and taking a cheap, crappy camera, maybe 30 frames per second, you can actually understand the blur and actually turn that into a high-frequency power spectrum measuring device, enabling you to measure the power spectrum of something that you can observe up to hundreds of kilohertz for dollars. And I always like that kind of stuff, coming up with like a simple and expensive way to do something to just give you the answer that you want, and also things like the centrifuge microscope. And we've been using these tools to study interesting problems in biology and in physics, from cleavage and blood clotting to fluid flow and protein mechanics and unfolding. A colleague and friend of mine, Seokjin Jun, was here a little while ago. You maybe heard his talk. We've been collaborating on, for example, studying the confinement and compression of chromosomes and microchannels to try to understand how chromosomes are structured and how they work and understand things like a replication, which is an interesting problem both in terms of biology and physics. And really, we like to come up with new ideas and have fun and collaborate with people and just figure stuff out. So I just want to thank you for your time and acknowledge some of the people. Ken Halverson, we were friends together in Evan's lab and grad students together. And then when I got my appointment at Roland, he came as my postdoc, and we've been having fun ever since. Diane Chack is a Roland staff scientist I hired who helps with some of the biology. And Daniel Cheng is the newest recruit to the team. He's a scientist technician who is a summer student with me and has joined my group in September. On the A2 work, I want to acknowledge Tim Springer and his group, Zhaowei Frank Zhang, who was one of his postdocs at the time but is a professor now in Pennsylvania, Shengzong Zhang, who was a postdoc and is currently a postdoc with Tim. And lastly, I'd like to thank the Roland Institute at Harvard for giving me the funding and the opportunity to have my own research group and to study these things. It's a really exciting place. If any of you are perhaps finishing up a postdoc or finishing up grad school and have questions about the programs there, you can let me know. It's a very special place where young people have the freedom to really do interesting things. And I'd also like to thank my future benefactors, Harvard Medical School, the Department of Biological Chemistry and Molecular Pharmacology, as well as the Immune Disease Institute and Program in Cellular and Molecular Medicine at Children's Hospital, and the Wyss Institute, where I'll be starting as assistant professor in the fall, and also provide the funding for me to start growing my group. So my group is very small but energetic, and will hopefully be slightly bigger and equally energetic in the future. But it's been great sharing these stories with you, and I'm open to any questions. And thanks for your time.